Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is, I believe, episode 257 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This podcast is actually going to be an unusually high-yield podcast. It's something that if you've taken any kind of practice exam, step one, step two, CK, step three, doesn't matter. I'm sure you've seen these questions in droves. These things show up all the time. So I will encourage you, before you take your exam, strongly consider listening to this podcast. It will for sure, almost certainly, net you a couple of points on your test. And I'm going to call this podcast the Clutch Bilirubin Podcast. The Clutch Bilirubin Podcast. The Clutch Bilirubin Podcast. And again, if you're interested in my USMLE classes, I have a Step 2 CK class coming up on the 5th of September, right? 6 to 10 a.m. Pacific time, 2-hour break. Noon to 4 p.m. Pacific time, 2-hour break, and then 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So if you're interested, just reach out to me, and I just use the contact thing on the website, and I'll be glad to point you in the right direction. Okay, again, many people have gone through the course. The overwhelming majority of people have found it to be extremely helpful. I've gotten many emails from people that have had very good scores, very strong scores coming out of the course on their real exam. Okay, so bilirubin. Right? Bilirubin, right? So what are the two big things with bilirubin? Well, let's think about this for a second, right? Whenever you break down red blood cells, well, what's going to happen to them, right? You form bilirubin. That bilirubin, doesn't just come out of thin air. Typically what will happen is, you know, as you're breaking down red blood cells, you'll form hemoglobin. That hemoglobin, right? Literally, I mean, look at the name, hemoglobin, right? It's like heme and globin. That globin, some magic stuff happens to it that I don't really care about for exams. But the heme is very important, right? Because that heme, there's an enzyme known as heme oxygenase, right? That will convert that heme to biliverdin. And then an enzyme known as biliverdin reductase. This is more for the step one folk, will convert the bilirubin to indirect bilirubin, right? But that indirect bilirubin can travel very well in blood, right? Indirect bilirubin is water insoluble, right? So the blood is a rough neighborhood for it, right? So what does that indirect bilirubin do? That indirect bilirubin needs like a buddy, right? You know, kind of like the way if you're getting into a rough neighborhood, you kind of need protection, right? So that protection, right, is going to be albumin. Albumin will, kind of chauffeur it around in the bloodstream until it gets to the liver. And then when it hits the liver, there's this enzyme known as UDPGT, right? UDP glucuronosyl transferase, right? That will convert that indirect or unconjugated bilirubin to direct or conjugated bilirubin, right? And in that conjugated bilirubin, it will go into the bile canaliculi. And then after getting to the bile canaliculi, it will come out, going to those intrahepatic bile ducts. And then over time, it will go into the extrahepatic bile ducts. And then, at the level of the sphincter of OD, right? Sphincter of OD, it'll get squirted out. It'll help you It'll help you emulsify, like fat and all that fun stuff, right? So that's like the life cycle of bilirubin. And then obviously some of it is going to be reabsorbed, right, in the terminal ileum. That whole process of enterohepatic recirculation. But again, I want to focus on bilirubin from a clinical perspective, especially for people taking step 2, CK, step 3. But this podcast, I can pretty much assure you that it will be useful for a person studying for step 1, right? So what are the two kinds of hyperbilirubinemia? There is indirect and there is direct. Again, remember, another name for an indirect hyperbilirubinemia is an unconjugated hyperbilirubinemia, right? Unconjugated hyperbilirubinemia. And again, if you understand this life cycle of bilirubin I just described, then you should be in pretty good shape, right, with many of these things, right? So let's kind of talk about this, right? So we know that indirect bilirubin, look at all the processes that happen prior to it, right? Red blood cell broken down, hemoglobin, heme plus globin, heme oxygenase to biliverdin, biliverdin to indirect bilirubin, right? So everything proximal to that, right? And then it's UDPGT that gets it from indirect bilirubin to direct bilirubin. So essentially, if you look at all those processes, anything that goes wrong prior to and including UDPGT will cause an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? So for example, they can give you a question about a person that has a history of lupus, right? And then the person will have like a hemoglobin of 8, and then you see their total bilirubin is 4, and the indirect part of it is like 3.5, right? That person has an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. I would hope under those circumstances, you're saying, sounds like this person has an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, right? Person has an autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Remember, that's a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, right? Because basically those people, they've made autoantibodies against their red blood cells. And those autoantibodies, they'll bind to their red blood cells, attract complement, and that will explode those people's red blood cells, right? So again, because you're breaking down so many red blood cells that at accelerated pace, right? That would absolutely cause, because UDPGT is an enzyme. So enzymes are saturable, right? Enzymes don't have unlimited capacity, right? So if you're breaking down so many red blood cells that UDPGT can't keep up with it, then your in-red bilirubin will go up, right? Or if they give you a question about some young guy, right? And, you know, they tell you that this young guy, you know, every morning he has hematuria and he has had like these weird arterial or venous thrombosis. I would hope you're thinking about PNH, right? Paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, right? That guy, right? Remember, those people, they have like this peak A gene mutation, right? Where essentially they're not able to make these GPI anchors. If you can make GPI anchors, well, things like CD55, your decay accelerating factor, or CD59, you're not going to be able to put them on the surfaces of red blood cells. And what do those things help you with? Those things help you prevent your red blood cells from exploding in under complement mediated damage, right? So if you don't have those things, well, bye-bye red blood cells. Your red blood cells are going to keep getting, they'll keep getting exploded, right? That's why those people have like hematuria in the morning, right? That's why those people have hematuria. So just something high yield to keep in mind, right? Because again, they're exploding their red blood cells. So again, as they are breaking down those things, they will just overwhelm UDPGT, right? And then again, if a person has sickle cell disease, right, those red blood cells, they tend to explode pretty easily, right? Because, you know, they don't have a good shape. They have that sickle shape, right? So they can explode easily. Or if a person has a thalassemia, right? Again, those red blood cells, they don't survive for very long, right? Because, again, because they have, like, abnormal hemoglobin, right? Those red blood cells, they tend to not deal with. When they get to the spleen is like, yeah, you don't look right. Those splenic macrophages, they're very gnarly, right? They're like, yeah, you don't look right. Come on. Let's go ahead and destroy you, right? And then the red blood cell gets destroyed, right? Or if you think of a person that, you know, let's say they tell you it's about like some kid or some person that has like HIV, right? And, you know, this person's CD4 count is like 150. And you're about to, you study them on TMPSMX. And then you notice that, man, weeks after this person studied on TMPSMX, this person is always fatigued, and then you check some labs, you notice that, oh, their hemoglobin is like 8, and then you notice that, the Coombs test here is negative, right? So that tells you that it's not an antibody-mediated cause of their red blood cells exploding, right? And you notice they have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. I would hope you're telling me that, oh, this person has a G6PD deficiency, right? G6PD deficiency, and, you know, I would hope you don't pick G6PD deficiency as the answer to a question that involves a woman on a test, right? Because women should, hopefully on NBME, is not get G6PD deficiency, right? Because remember, it's an X-linked recessive disorder, so it only shows up in guys on tests, right? So when you see something like this, well, TMPSMX is a very powerful oxidant, right? Causes powerful oxidative stress, right? So because it causes a very powerful oxidative stress, right? Again, your red blood cells, if you don't have G6PD, well, guess what? You're not going to be able to make any DPH. If you can't make any DPH, remember that pathway is like the hexose monophosphate shunt, which some people call the pentose phosphate pathway, right? If you're not making any DPH, then you've lost all your reducing power. So red blood cells, I mean, literally their life description is, oh, their job description is, oh, I carry oxygen. So if you then add on something that causes even more oxidative stress, when you have a deficiency of an enzyme where you can't make any DPH, you're going to keep exploding your red blood cells, right? So again, you have a ton of hemolysis. Basically, if you're thinking about this, it's like a common pathway, just leading to hemolysis, and then you overwhelm UDPGT, right? Or they can give you some question about like some European kid, right, that has anemia, right? And they say, oh, his dad or your grandfather, blah, 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 blah. They all had to have splenectomies for whatever, right? If you see that, right, I hope you're thinking about like hereditary spherocytosis, right? Hereditary spherocytosis, those people, again, they have a ton of, they have like these red blood cell membrane defects, right? Remember, if it's spherocytosis, it's like problems with like spectrin and ankyrin, right? If you have a spectrin or an ankyrin problem, right, then you're not going to have enough red blood cell membrane, right? And those red blood cells, because they are very, very tiny, right, they can't deal with much fluid getting into them, right? So they explode. They explode in the bloodstream, they explode in the spleen, right? Under the action of those splenic macrophages. Because think about it. Let's say you're a 25-year-old guy, right? And you're going to wear shorts that are worn by a 5-year-old. As you put it in, as your butt gets in, the shorts will just tear apart, right? Because there's just not much room for you, right? So when you have a red blood cell membrane defect, right? If you really think about it, right? Like, you don't have enough membrane, right? So the cell is very hypertonic, right? So if you put it in a hypotonic environment, as water rushes into that cell, the red blood cell membrane will just explode, right? And when it explodes, that's pretty much hemolysis, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons. But the thing, for the most part, though, that causes those cells to hemolyze is those splenic macrophages. Splenic macrophages, I think of it as like the quality and safety department of the body, right? Your spleen is quality and safety, especially for your red blood cells. If your red blood cells have weird shapes, weird inclusions, like a person that has like G6PD deficiency with those Heinz buddies and all that stuff, they're like, you don't look right. And then you just destroy the red blood cell, right? So when you destroy the red blood cell in that quality control department of the body, which is the spleen, then that red blood cell is not going to do well, right? You're going to break up those things. That's probably an example of extravascular hemolysis. Again, all common pathway. You break down red blood cells at an accelerated clip, right? You overwhelm UDPGT, and then the person gets into trouble, right? And then, I mean, if you also have like an actual deficiency of the enzyme, right, that you are not making, right, like the UDPGT enzyme, if you have like a legit deficiency, right, so let's say it's like a kid, right, and the kid can have like Crigler-Najjar syndrome. Crigler-Najjar syndrome, right, I think the Najjar is N-A-J-J-A-R. I don't know if it's Crigler-Najjar or Crigler-Najjar, I have no idea, but whatever. But basically, right, but the Crigler is C-R-I-G-L-E-R. And then Najjar, I think, is a double J, right? Crigler-Najjar, Najjar, I don't know. But basically, right, those are deficiencies of UDPGT. If you don't have UDPGT, well, I don't know. Even if you're making breaking down red blood cells at a normal clip, well, your body's going to have a big problem dealing with those things, right? So those people have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia because, again, they literally have a deficiency of UDPGT. Or, you know, they can give you a question about some person and they tell you that, oh, this person, you know, just had some acute illness. And then for the most part, they're asymptomatic, right? But they have like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, or maybe a person that undergoes surgery, right? And then after the surgery, you know, they have like this mild jaundice and this indirect hyperbilirubinemia. If you see that, think about Gilbert syndrome, right? Think about Gilbert syndrome. Remember, Gilbert syndrome, those people have like a partial deficiency in UDPGT. So whenever their bodies are stressed, right, whenever they undergo surgery or they have an acute illness, they'll have like this mild elevation in indirect bilirubin, right? If they have that mild elevation, that can absolutely, right, be from, again, just them overwhelming their UDPGT system because they, you know, they have some UDPGT, but they don't have much of it, right? But that some UDPGT they have can tidy them over under normal circumstances, right? But whenever the body is undergoing a lot of stress, right, the body is like really, really needs that UDPGT system to work. So those people essentially have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia in those circumstances, right? Or if we're thinking about a person that's a newborn, right? Why do newborns have physiologic jaundice? They have physiologic jaundice because as a newborn, you're pretty much not using your lungs, right? And if you don't use your lungs, what does the body interpret that as? The body interprets that as a relative hypoxia. And when you're hypoxic, what does your body do with regards to EPO? Your EPO will go through the roof, right? Your EPO will go through the roof. You produce a ton of red blood cells, right? So you may see some of these newborns. You're like, man, this newborn's hematocrit is like 57% at birth, right? Like some astronomical number. It's just because in utero, they're hypoxic because they're not using their lungs. It's like a physiologic style hypoxia, right? So that triggers the production of EPO from those peritubular cells, right, in the kidneys, right? So that EPO will cause them to make a ton of red blood cells, right? So when they're born, right, and their lungs start working, then the body's like, I don't need all these red blood cells anymore. And the body's also trying to get rid of all this fetal hemoglobin and all that stuff, you know? So the thing that will pretty much happen is the body will have to figure out a way to get rid of all those red blood cells. He's got to break them down somehow, right? And the thing is, kids, they don't start having decent, legit UDPGT activity until, you know, they're a couple weeks old, right? So in those first few days of life, as the body's trying to deal with that red blood cell problem, but you don't have much of any UDPGT to help with that, right? You're going to build up indirect bilirubin. You're going to get into trouble, right? Or if a kid has like RH incompatibility, right, or has like ABO incompatibility, again, those red blood cells, right, again, will be demolished by antibodies, right? I mean, the Rh antibody case, it's Rh antibodies. In the ABO incompatibility case, it's either like an anti-A or an anti-B antibody, right? So those will crush those red blood cells, right? And again, as you hemolyze them, you'll build up indirect bilirubin, right? Or if you see like a newborn, right, first week of life having indirect hyperbilirubinemia that is mild, right? And let's say maybe this newborn is not being fed often. Maybe the mom is feeding the newborn every 6 hours, right? Then that kid has breastfeeding jaundice. Breastfeeding jaundice is an example of an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, right? Another classic one you may see on a test is breast milk jaundice, right? But remember, breast milk jaundice will show up in the second week of life. Again, it's a mild indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Second week of life, again, that will also cause an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. I mean, people don't really know the pathophys behind the breast milk jaundice, but they think that the breast milk contains like some weird substance that inhibits UDPGT, right? That inhibits UDPGT, you know? So again, just things to keep in mind on exams, right? Things to keep in mind on exams. So I think I've really hit this indirect hyperbilirubinemia thing pretty hard. So let's maybe go ahead and talk about this. These are direct hyperbilirubinemias, right? So direct hyperbilirubinemias, let's maybe take it by age, right? So, you know, let's say you see a newborn that has a direct hyperbilirubinemia, right? Direct hyperbilirubinemia in a newborn, if you see that, you know, pretty much go ahead and stop reading the question. Look for the answer that says biliary atresia and be on your merry way, right? Biliary atresia, again, it's an obstruction. You have like fibrosis and all that stuff of the child's bile duct, right? So the child is not able to excrete bile, right? And remember, those kids, they need a liver transplant as quickly. No, actually, they don't need a liver transplant initially. You can do something called the Kasai procedure, right? You can do the Kasai procedure in the first, few days of life. If you do that, then they won't need a liver transplant. But once they've had it for like 4-ish plus weeks, then they need a liver transplant, right? So one of those things you want to catch early, right? So direct hyperbilirubinemia in a newborn, think about biliary atresia. If you don't see biliary atresia as an answer, go ahead and pick the answer that says cholidococyst, right? Go ahead and pick the answer that says a cholidococyst, right? And then remember, if they give you a question about like some kid, right? And this kid has a direct hyperbilirubinemia, but this kid has like no problems at all, right? The kid is asymptomatic, right? Then you want to maybe entertain the concept of the kid having like either Dubin-Johnson, right, or Rotor syndromes, right? And the big thing, the big way you differentiate between those two is the color of the liver. If the liver is black, right? If the liver is black, then you're thinking about a Dubin-Johnson syndrome. If the liver is not black, right, then you're thinking about a Rotor syndrome, right? Remember, those people, the pathophys behind Dubin-Johnson and Rotor syndromes, those people just have like a mutation or like the absence of a transporter, right, that helps you move direct bilirubin from the bile canaliculi into like the biliary tree, right? So if those transporters don't work, right, I think sometimes you may see them referred to as like MRP1 or something like that, right? Those things will cause backup of bilirubin. So those people have some kind of direct hyperbilirubinemia, right? And then if you're thinking about a middle-aged woman, you know, over the last 6 weeks, this middle-aged woman in her 40s, 50s, you know, she's having a lot of pruritus, has jaundice, has a direct hyperbilirubinemia. That's pretty easy, right? That's PBC, right? Primary biliary cholangitis, right? Remember, back in the day, they used to call it primary biliary cirrhosis, but they stopped doing that, right? So it's PBC. And don't forget, the kind of bile duct that's affected there is the intrahepatic bile duct, right? And it's the intrahepatic bile duct. Remember your anti-mitochondrial antibodies. And don't forget that orsodiol actually improves survival, right, in a person that has a PBC, right? Remember, orsodiol, sometimes on exams, they may refer to it as orsodeoxycholic acid, right? But if you see like a similar presentation in a guy, especially a guy that has a history of ulcerative colitis, right, you want to think about PSC, right? Primary sclerosing cholangitis. Remember, in PSC, again, these people have like this beads on a string pattern, right? Like these structures, right, in their intra and extra hepatic bile ducts, right? So again, the UDPGT step works just fine, right? But again, they're not able to excrete their bile successfully, right? So for those people, they will have a direct hyperbilirubinemia. Again, essentially, when you see direct hyperbilirubinemia, always think about some kind of obstruction, right? Always think about some kind of obstruction of bile flow, right? Some obstruction of bile flow. And remember, PSC, right, is P-ANCA positive. Well, if you're a medicine resident, that's not necessarily true, but most people listening to this are med students, so we'll kind of move on from that. But for exams, it's P-ANCA positive. And remember that Also, dial doesn't do squat for those people. I mean, like, if they can't get a liver transplant for whatever reason, what you can try to do is you can do like an ERCP and try to lyse or dilate those structures that you have in the biliary tree, right? That you have in their biliary tree, and that should help. And then, you know, if you're thinking more along the acute phase of things, right? So if you see like acute phase, a person has like, you know, for the last 3 days, they've been having jaundice and they have like mild right upper quadrant pain. And notice they have no fever, right? No fever, right? Then you maybe want to consider like choledocholithiasis under those circumstances, right? Remember, choledocholithiasis is when you have like a stone that's obstructing the common bowel duct, right? So, you know, you obstruct that common bowel duct, bile is not going to flow, right? So those people have a direct hyperbilirubinemia, right? And it will arise acutely. But again, they will have no fever. Because if they had fever in the setting of that right upper quadrant pain and jaundice, that'll be ascending cholangitis, right? That'd be ascending cholangitis, right? So just something to be mindful of on MBME exams, right? So ascending cholangitis, choledocholithiasis, those are basically causes of direct hyperbilirubinemia on exams, especially one that's more acute. Basically, ascending cholangitis is choledocholithiasis that then has fever, right? So most cases of ascending cholangitis will have started as choledocholithiasis that was not treated, right? That obstructing stone, you know, you have bile stasis, bacteria kind of build up behind it, and then the person gets in trouble, right? And then they can give you a question about a person that, you know, recently had like some kind of like cholecystectomy, right? And then they may tell you that, they may give you labs and you see that, oh, this person has some kind of direct hyperbilirubinemia, but this person is having like signs of peritonitis, right? If you see that, especially with that temporal association with a recent like cholecystectomy, you want to think about bile peritonitis, right? Like a, from like a bile leak, because bile is super irritating, right? To the peritoneum, right? So that person has signs of peritonitis, recent cholecystectomy or whatever, right? And then that will tell you that, oh, okay, I'm dealing with bile peritonitis here, right? From like some kind of bile leak. Usually for those things, those bile leaks are very easily diagnosed with a HIDA scan. A HIDA scan is amazing for those kinds of things, right? HIDA scan is very good for a bile leak. And one common question I get from students on that I tutor is, how do I differentiate bile peritonitis from like a retained gallstone, right? From like the gallbladder surgery. Basically, people that have a retained gallstone, they will have that direct hyperbilirubinemia, but they will not have signs of peritonitis, right? Because that peritonitis tells you that something is dripping somewhere and literally irritating the peritoneum, right? Irritating the peritoneum. And then one other thing, I guess, that may cause this direct hyperbilirubinemia on exams that you may, you know, want to consider is if a person has like pancreatic cancer, right? If a person has pancreatic cancer, remember, typically on like on an ultrasound, you may see this thing called the double duct sign, right? The double duct sign is classic in radiology. Those people have like dilation of the common bile duct and the pancreatic duct, right? Again, that's causing obstruction to flow, right? So conjugated hyperbilirubinemia, right? And then remember, sometimes people can have, like, they may tell you that, oh, a person, you know, has had like chronic cholecystitis or something like that, or had like penetrating injury to the abdomen, right? And then they tell you that, oh, that the blood, right, they test the blood and they see like it has like a very high bile content with like most of the bile being like direct bilirubin. That person has something called like a biliary vascular fistula, right? They can have like a fistula created between like the bile ducts, right? And like a blood vessel, right? And basically blood will be literally like siphoning into that person's, bile will be siphoning into that person's blood vessel. Or they may tell you that, oh, that they see a lot of blood in the biliary tree, right? They see a lot of blood in the biliary tree. That means blood is flowing through the fistula from the blood vessel to their biliary system, right? If you see that, again, think about a biliary vascular fistula, right? And again, remember, if a person has cholangiocarcinoma, again, that can also be a cause of some kind of a direct hyperbilirubinemia. And one thing, I guess, maybe let me wrap up with it, like the two patterns of liver labs, right? So remember, people can have like a cholestatic pattern of liver labs where their direct bilirubin is elevated, right? And they'll have like their alk force being elevated, right? The alkaline phosphatase. If the alk force is markedly elevated in relation to the AST-ALT, that's a cholestatic pattern of liver disease, right? Contrast that with like some kind of hepatic pattern of liver disease where the AST and ALT are disproportionately elevated compared to the ALK force, right? But let me talk about something that I maybe should call like an ALK force conundrum, right? If your ALK force is elevated, but your GGT is normal, that person has a bone problem that's causing their elevation in ALK force, right? For a problem to be of a biliary etiology and you're like, the ALK force is elevated, then typically the person's GGT will be elevated as well. Although there's this spanking new test, it's called like the 5' nucleotides. It's not actually spanking new, it's actually been around for a couple years, but you know, that could show up on an exam, right? The 5' nucleotides, if it's elevated, that also tells you that, oh, this thing is coming from the person's liver. This is an obstructive cause of this person's problem. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Unfortunately, because I need to run, I can't really talk about a life lesson today. But I promise in one of my podcasts coming out soon, I'll make a life lesson with that. So thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And then don't forget, I do actually have these podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play. So please subscribe, you know, rate this podcast. You know, it's always helpful. And then I also have a WordPress website. You can subscribe to it. You get an email whenever I make a new podcast. It's Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end .com. So thank you for listening. I wish you all the very best and God bless you. Thank you.